session number 10044, reel 7.
Mr. Powell, reel 7.
I received a summons to go to see General Lamplough, Royal Marines, who was to be the Director of Military Intelligence of the Southeast Asia Command. He offered me a position on his staff to do roughly the same work as I had been doing in India and to carry it forward during the operations which lay ahead. I declined because, for two reasons, both of which I explained to him. The first was that I was very uneasy in a joint headquarters, which would be joint between the British and the Americans. I had a rooted belief that the jealousy and rivalry between the United States and the Americans rendered
between
the United States and the British rendered them uncomfortable allies in the Far East. And the second reason was that by then I was deeply involved in India and had become deeply and personally attached to it. Naturally, this being my attitude, General Lamplough said, well, that settles the matter. And I remember marching back across the court of the Imperial Secretariat in Delhi into the Indian wing, Indian Army wing, and marching into General Cawthorn's office. It's all right, I said. What's all right, do you mean? Do you know what they did? Siag asked me to leave India and join them. I said I wouldn't. His face fell. He didn't get on very well with General Lamplough, but he had overcome his prejudices sufficiently for my sake to ensure that there would be a real live job for me with SEAC when the changeover took place. However, I declared my allegiance to India, an allegiance which in the event was to decide that I didn't have any part, direct or indirect, in the operations by which Malaysia were recovered. Upon such threads hang the disappointment of one's major intentions. I became Assistant Director of Military Intelligence, India Command, as a full colonel about that time. And there were two activities in which India was engaged at that time, which were relevant to the war in Burma and further east. The first was that the India Command had an exceptional unit dealing with enemy material. Enemy captured material, weapons and other material, were processed by a section of military intelligence in India, and the Indian Command remained the authoritative source of information upon Japanese war material, the quality and capabilities of Japanese war material. The second activity was perhaps parallel. There came into our possession about that time a recent copy of the Japanese army list. Curiously enough, and it's it's similar to other strange national characteristics of ours, the Japanese always included in the army list a note of the unit with which each officer was at the time serving. One had therefore only to reorganize the army list in terms of formations in order to create a key with which any officer, if identified dead or alive, could identify the unit and possibly the formation which was on the other side of the line. It's a relic of, it's a memory of the age before the computers. But on hearing of that document, I went into General Cawthorn and asked him for 60 slaves. I was given 60 slaves. That is to say, 60 people who would sit at desks in the gymnasium. Sitting at desks in the gymnasium, in a week, they transposed, by sheer manpower, the Japanese army list into what, from the colour of its cover, was thereafter called the Yellow Book of the Japanese Army, which became the interrogation officer's vade-mecum from then onwards, and was constantly kept up to date with supplements. There was a Japanese section in Military Intelligence India, which was staffed by officers who had been commissioned, pumped with Japanese, and sent out all raw to work in Japanese intelligence on Japanese material, since of course there was an inevitable shortage of officers capable of reading Japanese. These were attached to the India command, and I made myself thoroughly unpopular by insisting that these officers on arrival should do a month's attachment to the Indian army with a unit in Delhi, whereby they would at least get something to know, get to know something about India and about the Indian army. It was highly unpopular at the time and was also representing as holding up vital intelligence work, but I feel no repentance about it, and I'm sure neither did they when they had had that experience. I remained Assistant Director of Military Intelligence India until June, July 1944. It's something which I find almost impossible to believe now, as I reproduce this narrative, that the entire period, during the entire period from the landing of D-Day to VJ Day, I was in a sense encapsulated in India. So separate was the Eastern theatre from the European. So back to back were those views of the world, and so inadequate, in India at any rate, was the coverage, the day-to-day coverage of events in Europe, that I have to state that through all the vicissitudes from D-Day to VE Day, my mind was totally unaffected by the gigantic struggle in which Germany was destroyed by the Allies in Europe. So much so that when recalling all this story recently, I could hardly believe the chronology. In telling the story, for example, to my wife, who happened to be employed in the Chiefs of Staff office in London, it seemed to both of us simply incredible that one could have been so estranged for what is now, I now see in retrospect, was so large a fraction of the total war, that I should have been so completely estranged from the European campaign. Indeed, as I shall presently explain, I wasn't even directly focused, as I had hitherto been, upon the war in Burma, because in July 1944, instead of becoming, which I might at that stage have become, the Deputy Director of Military Intelligence, I became with promotion to the rank of brigadier, one of the three army members, of the four members of the commission on the post-war Indian Army set up under Lieutenant General Wilcox. The other members were Brigadier Gordon Thompson and Brigadier Caniapa, who was later to be the first Commander-in-Chief of the Indian Army. And there was an air member, Air Commodore Kingston McLaughlin, with whom I cooperated in two books which he published in the later 1940s. He was a regular officer, a regular RAF officer, who had previously studied the Northwest Frontier for the purposes of a report produced on the Northwest Frontier, specifically by General Tuker. So, my staff training, my army experience, and my immersion in India were activated by my duties as a member of that committee. I, in fact, drafted the report. Somebody has to draft a report, and I drafted the report. I don't say that I dictated the report. That would be a very different and untrue statement. But I drafted it, and to that extent, I helped in the creation of a report which, so I understand, dominated for a long time the military planning, both of India and of Pakistan, because the copies of the report which were available in Delhi were divided at the partition between the future Pakistan Army and the future Indian Army. It was, of course, an activity into which my absorption with Indian history entangled me, and I did write for that report what, at any rate up to that time, was the only conveniently available history of class composition and recruitment in the Indian Army. The committee was based in Dehradun, to which we returned for our drafting sessions from extensive travels and tours of investigation, which took us into all the major military establishments and all the military commands, from Peshawar in the one direction to Calcutta in the other direction, so that it was a marvelous survey of India as India was in 1944-1945. At the same time as this, I was working away at my interpretership in Urdu. I happened to have as my teacher a not undistinguished Urdu poet who was himself the nephew of the most famous of all Urdu poets, Hali, H-A-L-I is the name. And the two activities, I suppose, complemented one another.
Were you considering at that time the bringing in of more southern peoples into the Indian Army?
Yes, we believed that a gradual loosening of the class composition of the army was both possible and desirable, though it would have taken place much more slowly than I think was envisaged by the successor government. We also envisaged, though there's little point in my giving evidence verbally upon a written document, for there it is, and I've presented my copy of this, which I happen to have. I had two copies. One I gave to Field Marshal Auchinleck, and I never knew what became of it, long after the war. And the other copy has been reproduced for the India Office Library, and also for, I think the RUSI also has a copy. So I won't give verbal evidence on a written document. But certainly, not least under the prompting of Brigadier Caniappa, we looked into all the received wisdom regarding the composition of the Indian Army. What was fundamental about the report, and what was to influence my own mind and behavior 40 years later, when I was spokesman on defense of the conservative opposition, was the concept of a peacetime army as a basis for expansion. After all, India had exhibited a fantastic example of the expansion of a peacetime army of some 250,000 to 2.25 millions of men under arms by the end of the war. And it seemed to us that the logical way to construct a peacetime army was to ask what peacetime army would form the ideal basis for wartime expansion, and at what rate that expansion could take place. Obviously, the one was coordinate with the other. And I think probably that report was in a way unique in planning an army down to the smallest detail upon a theory of wartime expansion, a very un-English approach to a regular peacetime army. And it was done down to the smallest detail. We took the view that if we were going to produce a report on the post-war Indian Army, then it was our business also to produce the establishments. And we produced a two-volume report, and the second volume was a complete establishment of the post-war Indian Army. We also went into such questions as the position of the Viceroy's commissioned officer, the non-commissioned ranks, and the training of Indians as officers in the Indian Army. I suppose those are probably some of the more obsolete parts of the report. But I would think that for 20 years or so, it probably was fairly frequently referred to, both in Delhi and in Karachi. Simultaneously, I was travelling India on my own account, because I had learned to ride a bicycle. I had to go to India to learn to ride a bicycle. In India, one has to learn to ride a bicycle. And it must have been quite a historic moment when my second in command, in my number two, launched me on a bicycle at the top of Kingsway and said, "There you are, Colonel, off you go now, you can ride it now." The next morning, however, was not quite so easy. I fell off several times into the next man's veranda on remounting and collided in Kingsway with an underlit bullock cart. But I mastered the bicycle as the ideal method of learning India. And with my Indian servant, I used to travel by myself on my leaves. I remember, for instance, we spent one leave in Gujarat, because I was deeply interested in Islamic architecture. And we must certainly have made a curious picture, which I'm afraid wasn't cinematographed at the time, of a brigadier on the bicycle cycling along a bund, followed at several yards distance by his Punchi, for he came from Punch, a servant with red beard and flowing garb. It was one of his functions to raid the villages through which we passed for eggs and other eatables for picnic. I got very close, I felt, to the underside of India in those months. I was going to say years, but I realized they were no more than months. And that perhaps makes it easier to explain what I meant when I said just now that in 1946, when the war was over, had there been an Indian army in which there was a place for a British officer like myself, I would have stayed in India and spent the rest of my life there. We were in Dehradun when the Hiroshima bomb dropped, and Vijay Day had already passed when the report was turned in, I think, to the Viceroy and Commander-in-Chief in October 1945. Shortly after that, after a long interview with the Chief of Staff, I had come to the decision that there would be no future for me in India and in the Indian Army, and all that remained for me to do was still to sit my interpretership examination and come home. I had hoped to come home via Japan and the United States, which I had never visited. And I remember another incident there, because agreement to my doing this was withheld. And I remember telling an American officer of equal rank to myself that I would have liked to come back westabout, but that permission wasn't forthcoming. He said, "Why didn't you write your name across it?" A very interesting illustration of a different apprehension of a situation of an officer at brigadier level between the two armies.
You've been talking about your love affair with India. Can you tell me what the reason is? Was it because of the culture or because of the sense of a great empire that you had?
I wouldn't need to use the word love affair if I could explain it. For a love affair is something you can't explain, and that's why I like to choose this metaphor. But the unconstrained wonder of it, this unbelievable phenomenon of a vast continent with tumultuous history and a marvelous variety of languages and peoples cohering apparently effortlessly by reason of the improbable connection with it of a few thousand people from a group of islands in the North Atlantic. This is one of the wonders of the world. It's a phenomenon, and there was the phenomenon, and one was still able to live in it. It was like being, for an analogy, it was like being with Alexander in his army when he travelled from Greece to India. A miracle happened, and the miracle was still continuing to happen, despite the political accompaniment. But it was still there on the ground in India.
When you were doing your work with this committee on the Indian Army, did you give much consideration to the question of the defections from the Indian Army in Southeast Asia to the so-called Indian National Army?
No, I remember the Subhas Chandra Bose story and all that, yes. I remember that, and I remember the amnesty which was given, was it not, at the end of 45 or the beginning of 46. But I think if the matter had been raised in the committee, we would have said one of the assumptions which we are making in constructing this army is that it is an army which enjoys the support of the population. Subhas Chandra Bose, after all, was a manifestation of Japanese imperialism. It was the, like the famine in 42, It was Japanese made. The defeat of the European in Southeast Asia and the defeat of the European by the Japanese had repercussions right across Southern Asia. And Subhas Chandra Bose was one of those. He belongs with the history of Japan more than with the history of India. There's a defiant statement.
I think many would agree.
He doesn't belong with 1857. It's not part of the story of 1857.
You mentioned Wingate. Was that the only time that you met him?
Yes.
How long did you meet him for?
I suppose no longer time than it takes to get from the centre of Cairo to the airport.
Were you able to form any impression of him at all? As a man?
I was attracted by him. And he seemed to me a man under whom I would be happy to serve, especially if he would be the means of taking me where I then thought I wanted to go.
What was there about him that attracted you to him?
I liked his decisiveness, and I liked his special personality. He was hardly the very model of a normal regular officer, not even given that the British Army is, as I've suggested, a not unhappy home for idiosyncrasies. But I don't have a very clear picture. And I think my idea was, here is a show that's going on, and here is a show which one might be able to join. This is an opportunity not to be missed, if it can be grabbed going by.
Reverting to Egypt for a moment, one reads the literature that's been produced by people like Olivia Manning and Lawrence Durrell about this period in Egypt. Does the kind of atmosphere which they create in their novels, do you think it accurately reflects what it was like to be in Cairo and Alexandria in those days, do you think?
I can't help you, as I haven't read the novels. However, this you do prompt me to say, that there was a great difference in my situation in Egypt and my situation in India. In Egypt, I was still in the British Army. I was still consciously a part of that army to which belonged the Royal Warwickshire Regiment and the Budbrook Depot of the Royal Warwickshire Regiment, except that a piece of that army happened to be fighting on Egyptian soil or on the borders of Egypt against the European enemy. In India, although I was still British service, I was British service in India, British service as a component with the Indian Army. I was no longer part of the Home Army. I was no longer part of an army of occupation, an army in terrain where a campaign was being conducted.